That was fringe. That was far fringy from the mainstream conversation. And what's amazing is now so many large organizations have things like mindfulness as part of their programming. So it's, yeah, the world has definitely shifted, and it has moved towards really trying to get back to, you know, kind of in some ways, Frederick Winslow Taylor was talking, he moved human beings into human resources. And I think the next generation of human resources is about how do we reclaim the human and become more human beings at work.
Hey everyone, it's Matt here for another episode of Thinking Inside the Box, the show where each week we tackle the most complex issues related to work and culture. If you're interested in checking out our other content, you can find us at bentohr.com or wherever you find your favorite podcasts. In today's episode, we chat with Alan Hunkins, a sought-after leadership speaker, consultant, trainer, and coach. Alan's recent book, Cracking the Leadership Code, Three Secrets to Building Strong Leaders, launched as the number one best-selling new release in the business communication category on Amazon. And over his 20-year career, Alan has supported nearly 2,000 teams in 25 countries with clients as far-ranging as Walmart, Citigroup, IBM, and Microsoft. And he's designed and facilitated seminars on a number of leadership topics, everything from team building to conflict management, peak performance to innovation, and most relevant today, change. He serves on the faculty of Duke's corporate education program and has published over 400 articles on leadership. And that's our topic for today's conversation. We get into the history of leadership and more specifically leadership mindset and talk a bit about the idea of leader legacy. And Alan and I really dig into the idea of the fourth industrial revolution and specifically that a lot of our programs and delivery models and concepts really originate in the 20th century, in the industrial age. And that may cause some friction inside of organizations and for students. So we get into that. It was an awesome conversation. One of those ones where you go in with, you know, a real clear plan on where you want to go, but the conversation just flowed so organically that the script quickly went away and we just had an awesome chat. And I hope you enjoy it. So without further ado, Alan Hunkins. And I've now hit the record button, Alan, because I could not wait 1 second longer to have this conversation. How are you?
I'm good. I'm so excited to be talking with you today. Thank you.
I'm excited to talk about the past. A lot of people have been talking about the future, and I think that their assessments of the future are largely, you know, conceptual because we don't know what the future holds. But Alan, I love that when our last conversation that we had, we talked about leadership legacy. I want to dig into that. Before we do, I'd love to learn a bit more about you, your background, your experiences, and what led you to today.
Yeah. So yeah, probably when I was 5 or 6, I thought I want to do leadership facilitation and training when I grew up. No, I'm totally joking. I didn't say that. What little kid even knows that thing that even exists is a field, right? So for me, though, if I had to go back and I look at the common threads in my life, it's always been around people. I have always been really, really fascinated by why do people do what they do? Why do some people make one choice in a situation and someone else makes a different choice and their paths start to diverge? And if I had to think about it on a very personal level, it has a lot to do with my family of origin. So I have a fairly unique childhood. I was raised by a single mom in New York. That's not unique at all. And the unique part is that my mom is a Holocaust survivor. She was a child she was born in 1935. So she was in Belgium and her mom and her were separated. She was actually taken away from her mother at the age of 7 and placed through the Belgian underground for 3 years, basically moving from foster family to foster family, sometimes living in convents, having her hair dyed blonde and given a fake name in case of capture. I mean, some pretty crazy stuff to go through. I mean, I have a 13 and a 16-year-old now, and I just try to imagine what it'd be like to be the parent of someone through those years. Luckily, my mother and my grandmother were reunited at the end of the war. Unluckily, most of the rest of the family was killed. But as you can imagine, that experience completely shaped their worldview, and it obviously affected how they parented me. So I got some explicit and some implicit messages around trust and don't share more information than you're supposed to and things like that. And so the strange part, of course, growing up in New York City in the 1970s and 80s was, wow, my experience at home was so different from the experience at school or at my friends' houses. So I guess that's probably where I got my first dose of what organizational culture is really like, realizing how these cultures are so different from each other. And I think that my journey to explore leadership and culture in some ways is trying to make meaning and sense of my own experience. And as much as I wish I could have helped my mother and my grandmother to overcome whatever traumatic experiences they have, I think I've instead chosen to see, well, who else in the world can I help instead? So that's kind of what led me down this path of getting interested in the world of leadership training and organizational development.
It sounds like it kind of mirrors what we were talking about off air with regards to the leadership legacy that we find ourselves in. Alan, I'll be honest, my experiences, I don't know that they're unique either, but I remember an era where I joined the workforce at a time when predominantly people in leadership roles were baby boomers. And I remember I actually had a conversation this morning. I was working with Enrique Rubio, that runs a program called Cultivate, which is meant to work with the next generation of HR leaders. And we were talking about personal branding and about what the workplace was like in the mid to late 90s and how vastly different it is today around things like expectations around transparency and how information is a currency, less so now than it was back then. And some really interesting pieces. You know, from your perspective, what are some of the broader changes that you've seen so far as leadership over the last, the time in your career?
Yeah. So I've been at this with over 20 years. And as you described the 90s and thinking about baby boomers kind of in those roles, I mean, I'm a huge believer in studying your history, because if you don't know where you came from, you don't know how it impacts you. Yeah. And in fact, it's interesting. I got this lesson really clearly from my kids who are now, I told you, 16 and 13, but about the time they were 6 and 3, the two of them were goofing off in the living room, getting really, really loud. And I got to confess, Matt, I got a little triggered. And I turned to them and I said, would you two stop behaving like children? Now, I tell you this story for two reasons. Number one, that is a stupid, stupid thing to say, right? They are children. I said, calling them children is ridiculous. Number two, as soon as the words came out of my mouth, I was totally in shock, because would you two stop behaving like children was the exact same phrase my mom used to use with my brother and me when we were kids. So basically, unconsciously, I had copied the behavior of the previous generation. And I think about how people have been leading. Well, you see it especially with baby boomers, some of whom are still in the workforce for sure, but realizing that so much of our inherited leadership legacy is based on the work of the industrial age, the father of whom is Frederick Winslow Taylor, back in the days where 95% of the workforce was doing manual labor on an assembly line. And the value proposition was, leaders tell you what to do and your job is to shut up and do it. And like you said, so much has changed around transparency. And the fact is, with digitization, the idea of shut up and comply, like really? Really? I mean, the fact is, there is no longer this employment contract for life between things like LinkedIn and Glassdoor. People know where the grass is greener. Last time I checked with the Bureau of Labor Statistics, the median job tenure for workers aged 25 to 34 is 2.8 years. So the fact is, unless you can give people a compelling reason to stay with you, they won't, because they will look for something else. And they will trade one mediocre experience for another, because let's face it, it's commodity. And so realizing what can we do through how we lead and create cultures that attract people. I mean, another study I saw recently is the number one reason people would look for a new job is the inability to learn and grow. And certainly conversations about learning and growth were not on the table in the 90s. And in fact, even in the 2000s, we were not talking about things like emotional intelligence and authenticity and transparency. In fact, talking about emotional intelligence and emotions at work, if I was doing that in my work in the 2000s, that was fringe. That was far fringy from the mainstream conversation. And what's amazing is now so many large organizations have things like mindfulness as part of their programming. So it's, yeah, the world has definitely shifted, and it has moved towards really trying to get back to, kind of in some ways, Frederick Winslow Taylor was talking, he moved human beings into human resources. And I think the next generation of human resources is about how do we reclaim the human and become more human beings at work.
I always find that phrase ironic and a little bit, funny, and pardon the expression, Alan, but like, we've created the situation for ourselves. So we talk about this as some sort of abstract concept about human workplaces. We are literally in charge of our own destiny. And seemingly, at least from my perspective, we've gotten it a bit wrong. And I think whether, you know, you attribute it to legacy leadership values from a previous age, I have a lot of time for that argument. You know, I referenced this earlier, information was currency. And I remember a day when, you know, the superiors of the era would hold information and lord it over people in the organization and disseminate it when they felt it was in their best interest to know. And otherwise it wouldn't be shared. And when you contrast that with the expectations of our millennial and Gen Z and younger folks that have strong expectations around transparency, if you're not sharing information with them, they're asking themselves why. And then when you have the audacity to ask them to be engaged and committed, but then you aren't willing to reciprocate the level of trust back, people are quick to point out the inconsistency or the hypocrisy of that. So I think it's a really interesting dynamic. And I empathize with my colleagues that, you know, spent time working in, again, that boomer generation or that Gen X generation, because a lot of the behaviors that were ingrained in them, that were nurtured in them, that were grown in them over the course of their careers have all of a sudden declined in currency dramatically. And they're having to learn a whole bunch of new skills that translate more effectively for the digital era. And I'm sure you're seeing that when the clients that you're talking with.
Yeah, I am totally seeing that going on. And some people are struggling with this transition because, again, it's so easy to hold on to the things that you knew so well, and that's not being served anymore. But yeah, as you described, you know, we have moved from this world of information asymmetry, like you said, some people, a small group holding on to all of it, to now the playing field is level in terms of access to information. So I really see the shift for us as leaders throughout organizations is really getting away from thinking of ourselves as commander-in-chief to being the facilitator-in-chief. And as I write about and talk about, you know, I think there are these three overarching themes to be an excellent facilitator-in-chief. And it's all about connection, communication, and collaboration, right? So it starts by building real, genuine human-to-human relationships, because at its core, leadership is a relationship between two human beings. So it starts with connection, and then it gets to communication, but facilitative communication, which is looking to pull information much more than push it or drill it down, to use an industrial age metaphor, right? Kind of drill information down to them. And then the third piece is collaboration, right? So what are we doing to co-create solutions together? And I think by harnessing connection, communication, and collaboration, this next generation of future-ready leader is about facilitating. And I love the word facilitate because it comes from the same word in French as facile, to make things easier. I think our roles today is, how do we move information from where it is to where it needs to be? How do we transform that information into insight for the right people to have it at the right time so that we can get understanding, so we can make the best decisions to create the best results? And that is a huge mind shift. And like you're saying, I think there are a lot of particularly older generation folks in the workforce who are struggling to make that shift, because everything that they were told, and they said, wait, I paid my dues, I deferred, and I defaulted to authority. What do you mean you're not going to do it now? It doesn't seem fair. And you know it, it's not called fair, it's called change. So that's going on with that.
Yeah, and fair isn't equal to, right? Like, and I have a lot, like, again, like I said, I've had the benefit of working in five generations in the workplace as a function of my career. And because of just my own unique circumstances, like yours, a bit non-traditional, I was exposed to, I think, an earlier time in the workplace. So I have a greater appreciation and understanding for some of the decisions that are still made now that may seem out of touch with what's happening in 2020. I don't agree with them, but I have an understanding and an empathy for them, because to your point, we have individuals that before them saw individuals putting in time and in some cases sacrificing hours and work-life balance and various things, because longevity equated to loyalty and loyalty equated to reward. And reward was something that everyone was chasing. And now in a world where seemingly reward has been more democratized, it puts people out of queue and people do jump others in the order of, you know, promotion or access to different types of schedules or projects or privileged access. And you could argue whether that should be the way it is or not, but that is the way it is today. And some people have been disadvantaged by that, and some people have been advantaged by that, as there is always a dissonance between, you know, what happens for various stakeholder groups. What I get excited about in this context, though, is because it democratizes access, it provides fair opportunities for people to, or I should say more fair. I don't believe that it's entirely fair, but certainly more fair opportunities for folks to have success. And when you're not just using tenure or seniority as the primary driver around value, you get to have some really interesting conversations, particularly in an era where we're in a digital economy, we're in a knowledge-based economy. The skills that we're learning now and that are important 5 years from now weren't important 10 years ago. So longevity isn't as valuable as it once was. In some cases, actually, it could be perceived as a hindrance, because what we're looking for now, at least from my vantage point, when I'm talking to senior level HR leaders or to business executives, they're looking for things like agility and adaptability and learning aptitude, because they need to be able to know that when they're making investments in people that they can grow along with the organization, that's likely to transform many times over in the next 3 to 5 years. And certainly in a post-COVID world, we can expect a more rapid rate of acceleration, and companies need to keep pace with that rate of innovation. And that means they need to bring their collective employee bases along with them to ensure that they can meet the demands of their customers and stakeholders on a go-forward basis.
Yeah, I would completely agree with that. I mean, as you describe that need for flexibility and agility, what that makes me think about is, I think the COVID pandemic is a great example of just how many sacred cows have been slaughtered in the last few months, right? Just considering the fact that, you know, so many people who said, oh, we could never have our workforce work from home. Well, guess what? They're working from home. And you know what? They're actually managing okay. You know, and so that's just shifting this paradigm over and over again about how people can work and even the nature of what it means. So how we move forward, yeah, flexibility and continual learning and growth is so important. And all the research that studies learning and growth shows for people to be able to learn and to grow, they need to have an optimal environment. And what we need to do, and I was just actually talking with a group that works for a large financial services company earlier today about this, is in some ways as leaders, it's our job to create a climate of growth through calming people's central nervous system. That is through connection and basically letting them know that they're not under threat, but that their ideas are welcome, that when they throw out new ideas, we don't shoot them down, but they're actually nurtured and promoted so that people want to give more of that, because this need for creativity and this need for information coming from so many different places and doing the best that we can to figure out how do we combine and blend ideas so that we can develop and then iterate and then test and then see that works and then go back. I mean, this constant innovation cycle that is going on, and people want to be a part of it. I mean, particularly as you're saying, the younger generation is just, that's what they're excited for. And so how do we as leaders create those climates? And to me, it's about understanding what the needs are.
Hey everyone, it's Matt here. I hope you're enjoying the show. Before we continue, I wanted to give a quick shout out to one of our sponsors, Benji. The future of work is today. And Matt Parsons and the team at Benji have figured out a really cool hands-on learning solution that you need to be considering as you transition your organizational learning and team building and engagement online. Now, I spend several hours a day myself on video platforms. So whether it's Zoom or Skype or GoToMeeting, they're great. They allow me to interact with people and see them in all parts of the world. Though if you're like me, once those calls go on a bit too long, I start to get a little bit distracted. And it's not too long before I'm reaching for my smartphone or opening up another tab on my laptop. That doesn't happen with Benji. They have a catalog of interactive team exercises that makes it really easy for organizations and individual consultants to develop engaging solutions at any scale. And I'll be honest, I've been so impressed with the tool myself that we're actually looking at using Benji to power our virtual workshops with client-facing products. So I'm actually working right now with Matt one-on-one to develop a journey mapping exercise so we can take clients through the employee experience and illuminate thousands of dollars and hours of inefficiencies that organizations tend to have in their onboarding and hiring processes. It's a great tool. And because you are a listener of the Thinking Inside the Box podcast, you're going to get a special benefit as well. I've talked to Matt. He wants to give as many people as possible access to this tool so they can make online learning more engaging. And you can do so as well by using the discount code BENTO20. So if you log on to the Benji website, which is mybenji.com, and you're as impressed with the solution as I am, then enter the code in BENJI20 and you'll receive 20% off your purchase. And with that being said, we'll return back to regular programming.
And there's not a one size fits all. Like everyone needs this. It's just like, no, this is all tailored to the person. I mean, we live in this age of personalization. I mean, just think about how, I mean, the classic example is when you click on your, you know, your Amazon page is like, these are suggestions for you. Like this whole sense of tailor-made algorithmic life is that people want to feel that they are being spoken to directly and personally and customized. And so how do we learn how to, in our systems and practices, use technology to tailor a more personalized experience that helps to meet the needs of employees so they can actually show up and do great work?
Which should be the goal. And I struggle at times having conversations with certain segments of leaders. And this is not a generational conversation. This is expands all generations in my experience. But I struggle with some values that people hold that seem to conflict with business science. And here's what I mean by that, Alan. I've been lately talking a lot about evidence-based business principles. So these are things that we know to be true in very controlled environments and tested in certain situations. I'll give you an example. One of them is that we know that in a knowledge-based economy, there's a strong link between intrinsic motivation and discretionary effort.
Right.
That if people really want to do their best work, if they feel internally driven to do that, they're likely going to give you more discretionary effort over a longer period of time than if they are operating in an environment where it's fear-driven. So where they feel like they have to hit a certain target or there's consequences. We know that that has a limited shelf life. It works very well in the short term with human beings, but over the long term, it burns people out. It doesn't add to innovation. It actually stifles it. It doesn't create engagement. It limits succession. All these studies are present. And we have leaders still today that evangelize business models or leadership models that closely mirror that. Largely because, to your earlier point, that's what they experienced and that was what they benefited from. So they're essentially projecting their experience on the next generation of workers, blind to the fact, or perhaps just ignorant to the fact, that the world has changed and that they can apply the same rules as before because you're no longer assembling widgets on an assembly line. We're now operating in a world where we have immersive technology operating in parallel with the 2D world. So like it's a different conversation. And why I struggle with that is because oftentimes there are some of those same people are listing financial reasons or business reasons so as to why that you can't make more investments in their people. So they'll say we can't invest in things like succession or diversity and inclusion or engagement because we have a business to run first and those things come secondarily, which just further illuminates their lack of knowledge, again, when it comes to business principles as it relates to investments in those areas and the corresponding benefits to organizations. So I struggle with people choosing to be ignorant to the evidence around them when we have lots of studies that show us what things are effective and what aren't. And the way I've chosen to solve for that problem is just simply to illuminate it, because I think a lot of times it's not malicious. It's just simply a lack of knowledge, or again, it's experiential and therefore they think they're doing what's in the best interest of the people around them. But I think anything we can do to illuminate some of the things that you've mentioned and to illuminate the strong evidence-based reasons for them is only going to help us advance this conversation so it doesn't become a qualitative, why is HR advocating for culture conversation like it tends to be, and more is, why aren't we doing the things that are best in service to our business?
Let me ask you a question about that. Okay, so you just talked about how people are basically not doing, even though we know there's the science, and they come up with all kinds of good justification. So here's my question for you, Matt. So if people, you know, people in the business world are very good at saying, spinning things in a certain way. So what if instead of saying, well, no, actually, if we do these things, what if underneath that, the real reasons that they are not shifting to what we know from the science point of view has to do with, and I'll just use some basic bold words. One is that they're lazy. The fact is they're comfortable doing it the way they do it and they really don't want to change. So one is maybe they're lazy. How about another one? It has to do with the fact that maybe they're leading, let's call it, from fear, because there's a part of them that actually likes being in charge and enjoys the power. You know, there's great studies about the fact that the more power people have, the less empathy they have. And that absolute power, you know, corrupts absolutely. So there's power. And then the other thing is that are people, even though they say these things, are they really willing to let go of control? So what are your thoughts on the fact that maybe those are some of the ulterior shadow motives that people in polite company wouldn't actually talk about?
I don't know that they're all that shadow. So I think they're there. And I think inertia is a really powerful force. And I say this with a level of bias, knowing that I operate in my day-to-day life, a digital transformation consultancy, where I can put business cases in front of desks that can deliver 10 to 15 to 20 ROI on your investment. But inertia will often say, I don't have the mental capability right now to be able to think through how we lead a transformational project. Even though it may make sense financially, even though it may make the company healthier, we don't have the internal mind share to be able to move an agenda this large in amongst all the other large transformational projects that are occurring in the company. That's an absolute reality today in every single Fortune 1000 organization. You're fighting, you're putting business cases on the table, and they're all good. But you have to choose which ones are better than others and which ones are more strategically aligned potentially to a three-year goal, five-year goal. But in some cases, they're being decided based on three-month goals because it's about a quarterly earnings statement and the share price. So I think there's a lot of factors, Alan, that conspire to allowing us to advance it. And I think that, at least in my case, I'm trying to differentiate the things that I can influence versus the things that I can't. For the person who likes power and really revels in the idea of lording power over somebody and likes the idea of, you know, suspending people in a state of fear because it keeps them on edge or gets their best work, or like, I like creating chaos because it gets people like all motivated, though that's not real. And that person is just living in a fantasy world, unfortunately, and they're hurting the people around them. And I would ask them to stop. Like, that to me isn't a conversation around education. It's really around like, what you're doing doesn't make sense. That isn't actually a thing. It may work in very specific environments, but I think even what we're seeing now, Alan, I mean, one thing I would have often heard in retail was the linkages between retail teams and sports teams. We're competing, you know, this is how sports teams are act. You know, we make guys uncomfortable. Like we never let them get, you know, confident with their own performance because we want them always fighting for the fact that they have to fight for their job. And like, there's a level of like survival instinct that you're trying to build into resources like that. And now studies are showing that in a lot of cases that doesn't work with athletes either. That sports psychology has now proven that berating people and ostracizing them and making them feel bad about themselves doesn't drive performance in athletics in the same way it doesn't drive performance in business. So I think for those folks, they need to take a long, hard look in the mirror and ask themselves why, and be willing to face the fact that what they're doing doesn't work, and that what they're doing is self-serving, and there's a cost to what they're doing. So that is something they should be sitting with. When it comes to laziness, like I struggle with that, as I mentioned, because part of it could be desire, but don't have the mandate. Part of it could be, you're right, I'm 3 years from retirement. And Alan, I don't want to do anything all that disruptive. The last 3 years of my career, I've already spent the first 37 of them doing really busy stuff. I just kind of want to ride things out. And I saw the people before me, my previous generation, my previous bosses got to do the same thing. Their last 5 years, they got put out to do something different. And I think, Alan, there's actually not a bad argument to be made, but what happens is that we misalign those resources to the roles in the organization, which necessitate different behaviors. So I'm all for having leaders in organizations be assigned to ambassador roles or to partnership roles or to perhaps like in-house, you know, like institutional knowledge sources. And that's really important. And that has value. You could have them be mentoring new leaders and being cultural torchbearers and all those things. But if you're asking them to lead divisions that include innovation going forward, you're doing both parties a disservice if that's the type of mindset that leader has. Because nowadays we don't have an option. We have to transform, and organizations have to be effective in both virtual and physical environments to be successful, because the last I heard, we're still not out of a pandemic yet. And there's no light at the end of the tunnel as far as I can see in terms of a vaccine in the next 6 months. So we have to be comfortable in oscillating between virtual and physical. And that necessitates a level of technological and data advancement, which we just don't see in most organizations. So in those cases, I would encourage people to look at the burning platform in front of you and understand that if you're misaligned in the role that you're in, I get it, then you should be trying to find a role that better fits what you want in the remaining years of your career. Because by staying in the role that you're in right now and blocking change, you again are hurting people around you.
Well said.
I get frustrated because like you can't have it both ways, right? Like,
yeah.
Like I get it and I understand, but if your mindset is, I don't want to do more work that's harder for me, but I'm willing to let people around me suffer, I have a hard time with that argument. I know they're not thinking that. That's not the actual internal dialogue, but that's what the consequence is, because there are better ways to do the work. There are ways we can leverage technology and data to make workplaces more human-centric.
Yeah.
We can apply 21st century leadership practices across all generations.
Yeah. As you describe that, you know, one of the words that you use is like the willingness to take a hard look in the mirror. And I just want to come back to that, because I think, you know, that ability and the willingness to look in the mirror. I mean, that's the basis of emotional intelligence, right? Self-awareness. Are you willing to look and see the impact you have? And as you also described, an analogy I often use to describe this is that of a pendulum, is recognizing that, you know, and as leaders within larger organizations, we sit, if you think about holding us like a plumb line, a pendulum that swings in between your forefinger and your thumb, leaders sit up at the top of that little string. And they don't recognize that just a little bit of motion back and forth, like they're like, well, it's just me. I'm just doing this thing. A little bit of motion back and forth creates the bottom of the pendulum starts swinging wildly. And so to realize the ripple effects of the impact that we have as leaders, and to take ownership and accountability for, we are doing, we're having an impact, whether we think or not we are. And that's why it's so important for leaders to not just become self-aware, but then are you creating an open and honest dialogue with people to find out how is what you're doing working? And then your willingness to change your approach, right? Like you're saying, we're wanting our people to be all flexible and engaged. Well, why should they be engaged if our leadership isn't being engaged? Why should they be flexible if we're not being flexible? So again, like you said, things have been democratized. The playing field has been leveled. And for a lot of leaders, they're going, wait a minute, this doesn't seem right. I didn't play by these rules. And yes, the rules have changed because the world has changed.
And there's still enough for everybody. Like there's still like, I really try and reinforce for leaders to go away from this scarcity mindset. Just because someone else is getting something doesn't mean you've lost something. You can have it both ways. And you may have to reframe the measures of success. You may have to reframe your expectations, but there's a significant value in having five generations worth of workers in your workplace. The amount of breadth of knowledge and perspective is representative of your customer or your stakeholder. And you want that in organizations. And we don't want to, you know, denigrate people from previous generations for the things they've done. We wouldn't have gotten to this place if it wasn't for their efforts. And we also need visibility and we need the flexibility to be able to move forward in a way that's going to be in service to the collective on a go forward basis. And when it comes to leaders, I couldn't agree with you more. I think about something simple that we did, Alan, like, you know, we were a digital transformation consultancy that also had to make changes as a result of the coronavirus, because frankly, we had let some internal practices become informal and necessitated more physical contact. And we just had to go back to the drawing board and tighten up a couple things in our sales process that needed to be a bit more formulaic and leverage a bit more technology. So even we had to make changes. I can imagine other organizations had to make much more material changes. But one of the things that we did first off, when it became clear that we were going to go through what was going to be beyond just a news story, but there was going to be some consequences in terms of lockdown and potentially some travel restrictions, we called all the people in our organization one-on-one and just simply said, we're going to be okay. Like, the company is going to be fine. We're a digital transformation consultancy. We are going to be very busy throughout and after this particular event, because it's going to necessitate organizations to acquire services that we provide. So in amongst all the other things in your life that you have to worry about, whether it's housing, your health, your family, your friends, your loved ones, your job doesn't need one of those things. You're going to have some financial security, and thank you for your contributions, and take some time to figure out some things in your personal life. And we'll reconvene, you know, in a few days or next week to begin pivoting this business to be most in service to our clients. And just the act of having those 15-minute conversations drops everyone's anxiety down materially. And now they can focus on doing the other things in their life that also will reduce their, you know, complexities. And then we as a business can go back to being productive and in service to our customers. And I think that's a 15-minute conversation that doesn't require extra resources, doesn't require a big financial spend. It's just the thoughtfulness around understanding that your employees are feeling the same level of anxiety that you would be as a leader as you're trying to navigate what is, frankly, turbulent times that nobody has a playbook for.
Yeah. Yeah. And see, what I love about that example you just shared is the fact that it's, like you said, it's 15 minutes. It's so basic and yet it's so human. And I saw a study a couple of weeks ago and saying that about 40%, I think it was a US study, 40% of US workers, that no one from their organization, even though they'd all been kind of shifted and working from home, no one had stopped and asked them, how are you doing with all this? Like they just continued on. Now, okay, we're working from home. It's now, this is the new normal, business as usual. And to me, that just boggles my mind, because you said 15 minutes, it's so basic. And of course, realizing that we're all in the human being business, right? We're working with people. We have to understand that. And it's not about being a licensed psychologist. It's just thinking, if I was in their shoes, what would I be thinking? Wow, I'd be really stressed out about everything. What's one thing I can take off their plate to stress about? Oh, work. And you did that. And so to me, it's, again, it comes back. So many of these things, I feel like they come back to this common sense that is not common practice. And I just would love for more human being conversations to be going on, because that makes such a difference.
So Alan, as we go forward, I think we agree that we're going to have to develop new skills as leaders. Even those of us who've been acquiring new skills, we're going to have to learn how to work in a different way, both individually, but also within the context of a broader team. As you look forward, what are some of the things that you think that as leaders we should be looking out for, or some of the tips and tricks that you'd recommend that we could be applying just to ease this transition for ourselves?
Yeah. So one of the things has to do a lot with recognize, and you talked about this a little bit when we were talking about intrinsic factors of motivation. The fact is, as leaders, we really can't motivate anyone else, but what we can do is we can create the conditions where motivation is most likely to happen. And for me, I got really excited when I started studying behavioral economics and this whole theory of what's called choice architecture, is that while we can't make people do things, we can gently nudge them in a certain direction. So the classic example in choice architecture is, if you want to get people to eat smaller portions of food, you serve it on smaller plates, because it then is perceived as taking up more of the plate, and people it's weird, but it works. So the idea is that, how can we start to become leadership choice architects for our work environments? And from the work I've done, I found that there's four major needs that people have that need to be satisfied in order for them to show up and perform at their best. And so I think thinking about these things is a huge piece. So the four needs, that starts with safety. So obviously right now with coronavirus, it's physical safety. So is it actually physically safe for us to be together? No. So we're going to work from home. Obviously we'll be shifting into something else when we start to return to work in whatever fashion it is, but there's physical safety. But another big piece with safety is psychological safety. So what are we doing with our teams and our individuals to make sure that they can feel safe to bring their whole selves to work? I know that Deloitte did a study that said 61% of people feel like they have to cover their identities because they don't feel safe bringing themselves to work. So leaders need to recognize that. And what are you doing to make sure that everyone gets equal airtime, that you are hearing people, you're not cutting them off, right? So these are aspects of psychological safety. So beyond safety, then there's energy. The fact is, what are we doing to create a high energized work culture? Simple things like, are we scheduling our meetings for 60 minutes, or can we change the scheduling to 50 minutes so people have a 10-minute buffer before the next meeting starts? You know, I've been coaching people on that recently, and they're going, oh my gosh, what a difference that makes. I don't feel like I'm, by the fourth or fifth meeting, I'm losing my mind. You know, simple things like that to consider. Doing things like that. Also, you know, are you having meetings that are going on for 2 and 3 hours? The fact is, biologically, people can't go for more than 90 minutes. So scheduling and break. So we have this need for safety. We have this need for energy. Then also helping people understand what their needs are around purpose, that people want to feel like they're contributing to something bigger than themselves, that what they do really matters. So what are you doing to show people what we do as an organization is mattering? For example, are you bringing in customers who are sharing stories of how what your service or product has been doing to make their lives better, so people can see the direct connection between what they do day to day and the impact it's having? And then the fourth one is around ownership. So what are you doing to create an environment where people can make their own decisions and have some freedom and autonomy about how they go about doing their work? Like, none of us like a micromanager. So what can we do to give people very clear parameters on, here's what needs to get done, here are the deliverables, and how can you go about delivering them? I think especially now in this work from home remote environment, I've been coaching people around, you know, what if you started thinking about your team of people like a group of independent consultants, and that you need to scope out the project in advance and draft a letter of intention or a statement of work so that people are clear, because we don't have that face-to-face, I'm looking over your shoulder. And it's a very different way of thinking. Obviously, it's moving much closer towards this idea of a results-only work environment, and that giving people that freedom and latitude to do that. So again, just to recap those four needs: safety, energy, ownership, and purpose. I think if we can start to work to design environments where those needs are met on a more consistent basis, then you're going to see people being able to really thrive at whatever they do.
I love that, Alan. Thank you so much for your time today. It's been great to connecting. Always enjoy our chats, and looking forward to chatting with you again soon.
Thank you so much, Matt. I appreciate it.
At Bento HR, we enable your HR strategy with custom HR technology procurement, implementations, and integrations to liberate your team from administration, enhance their productivity and experience, to position them at the center of your organization's transformation, where they belong. With experience as an HR executive myself, I have a real appreciation of the challenges facing today's HR leaders. The world is changing. Your industry is being disrupted. Your organization is transforming. And all the while, you're trying to do more with less. You're being asked to simultaneously model fiscal restraint while the expectations of your departments are only increasing. At Bento HR, we can support you at every stage of your transformation, from architecting the strategy to developing and selling the business case internally. We support procurement, implementations, and ongoing sustainment. And we tie it all together with a deep knowledge of the HR profession and over six decades of combined experiences from our founding team, who has worked in or supported large HR organizations across multiple industries, including, but not limited to, financial services, technology, retail, transportation, and healthcare. Check out Bento HR today to build your very own Bento box, which doubles as your business case for transformation. Leveraging recent research into the upside of digital automation inside organizations, and with your help in answering a few simple questions related to your organization, our Bento Builder will provide a directional business case for change. So log on to www.bentohr.com and build your Bento box today.